Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
And despite the fact that it's Thanksgiving, we're still going to do a podcast.
Yes, we are, because, well, it's kind of a holiday that kind of goes with us, and we won't make any obvious jokes.
Like turkeys?
Like that kind of jokes, exactly. No, actually, I think of us as cranberries.
Do you?
Yes.
And happy Thanksgiving, Ron.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Ken.
Speaking of turkeys, we have a podcast this week and a foreign policy debate, the latest in a series of sitcoms on TV.
That's right. We've had roughly a dozen debates, depending on which you count and which you don't. And this week, the debate was about foreign policy. Here's an irony about that foreign policy debate. All the stories today were about what is essentially a domestic issue in the United States. They sort of backed into it talking about foreign policy and immigration, and then pretty soon they were talking about how we were going to treat people who were in this country illegally, which is not so much a foreign policy question as a domestic policy
question. And obviously you're talking about the Newt Gingrich response.
If you've come here recently, you have no ties to this country, you ought to go home, period. If you've been here 25 years and you got three kids and two grandkids, you've been paying taxes and obeying the law, you belong to a local church, I don't think we're going to separate you from your family, uproot you forcefully, and kick you out.
Now, basically, it's not too dissimilar what Rick Perry said a while back about immigration, and Perry got hammered for it. Newt Gingrich, I suspect, you know, it's still early, I suspect he will not pay the price, although everybody kept saying it's amnesty, he's hurting himself with Tea Party conservatives. I wonder about that.
Well, it's interesting. Right away, Romney said, well, that's a magnet. That's just going to be a magnet for more people to come illegally if you allow folks who have been here for a while.
And Michelle Bachmann talked about amnesty.
She immediately said, oh, well, that makes 11 million people who are here illegally suddenly legal. Gingrich had made it quite clear. He was talking about people who had been here a long time. And I thought for a moment there he was making so much of a point of that. He was trying to appeal in particular to people whose values are centered around their church, because he kept going back to that again and again. But all the other candidates saw this as their opportunity to dogpile on Newt and misrepresent what he was saying and make it sound as though it was blanket or were blanket amnesty for all people in the country illegally.
But if he was coming up with a centrist policy on immigration, which I thought it was, I'm wondering, for the first time, do you think Newt Gingrich sees himself as a potential nominee and something that could play well in the general election in November?
Exactly. My first thought was, wow, he's already talking like a general election candidate, a little bit like Rick Perry was back in an early debate when he spoke proudly of his program in Texas, passed by the legislature, that was allowing people to pay in-state tuition who were children of illegal immigrants. That was very unpopular with the Republican base and really hurt his standing as the anti-Romney conservative option. But then some other things happened to him, too, so it got a little unclear where exactly his weakness was.
And I think that's exactly the difference between Perry and Gingrich, because if you're looking at a series of debates, Gingrich seems to be impressive. Look, he can be cantankerous. He can be obnoxious.
Acerbic.
Well,
that's our favorite word. We like acerbic.
Well, I think Milosevic was acerbic, I think.
Wow.
Right. So I just thought that the fact is that having come off a series of impressive debates, now, of course, Newt Gingrich can be obnoxious. He can be the smartest boy in the class. He can be
Mr. Smarty Pants.
He can be condescending, but at the same time,
he can be nasty.
He can, but he also knows his facts, and nobody can say that Rick Perry has given that given a series of debate performances where he knows his facts.
You know, one of the values that they've had, and granted, they're not great television, and many times they're really not bringing out the best of the candidates. On the other hand, we have had a chance to see, shall we say, some of the flaws and debilities of some of these candidates.
Oh, yeah.
For example, Herman Cain last night, I thought, was particularly at sea at several times. And when he said what we should do with Syria, stop buying their oil, we already cut off any imports of oil from Syria back last summer.
And this comes right off the disastrous answer that Herman Cain gave to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel when he talked about Libya and his differences between President Obama on Libya policy, indicating that he had no idea what or where Libya was.
Or what the policy was,
right,
or whether or not he would agree with it. So that,
this
I think, has come
suit.
Up. That's right. Foreign policy is not his strong suit. Actually, I feel that his debate performances have essentially become predictable, and they're, you know, he doesn't even get really a chance to get into his usual spiel anymore. So I feel like the debates have hurt him as well.
Look at the numbers. The numbers, the last time we saw it, like 14%, far different than when it was the 26% that we've been seeing prior to the sexual allegations, the missteps, and the misstatements in the debates.
And it is difficult to sort this out, and it's going to be a problem as we get a little bit closer here to Iowa and
New
Hampshire.
6 weeks away.
Just 6 weeks away. what are the actual causes for the rise and fall of some of these candidates? We can't really tell because the polls only tell us who's going up and who's going down. We don't really know why. So we thought we knew why maybe Rick Perry was having problems initially. Then it seemed to be the debate performances, and that was the dispositive reason. Then with Kane, you know, we thought it was sexual allegations. Then it appeared to be more a question of whether or not he had any real preparation as a candidate. Then now with Gingrich, we've got a lot of negative stories out there. We've got the stories about what he did for Freddie Mac for millions and millions of dollars.
Well, 1.6 million.
Well, for Freddie Mac, but then there was the lobbying that he did with respect to health care in the last decade, particularly in favor of the mandate.
I wouldn't say lobbying. I would say he was a historian.
Oh, that's right. He was either a historian or he was providing strategic guidance. Strategic historic counsel.
Right.
And also, of course, being paid a great deal of money by people who had a direct interest in the legislation to speak to people who were going to be putting together the legislation. So,
which is remarkable because in a previous debate he talked about Barney Frank should go to jail for his involvement with the Freddie Mac. So, right?
There are vulnerabilities out there for Newt. Then there are the personal stories and so forth and the demeanor and so forth.
Yeah, except the thing about Newt is that I think for most Americans, we had no idea who Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, even Rick Perry were until we saw them in the debates. People have known Newt Gingrich. They've had opinions about Newt Gingrich since the 80s.
Yes, most of those opinions have been negative since the 90s, since his time as Speaker of the House.
Right.
So it's interesting to see the degree to which he's been able to turn that around, at least within that portion of the Republican base vote that is now saying he's their choice for president.
Now, we've gone a lot in this podcast, didn't mention, I don't think, the name of Mitt Romney. Again, if you talk to the Democratic National Committee, Mitt Romney is a nominee because they attack him left and right, or left and left, I should say.
Well, and the White House does constantly.
Absolutely. They went ballistic over an ad that Mitt Romney had out this week, basically taking out of context what President Obama said about the economy in 2008.
If we keep talking about the economy, we're going to lose.
Yes, you could say that was taken out of context. I mean, Obama was directly quoting back in 2008 somebody on the McCain campaign who had said those words.
Yes, but
and so now, of course, you take that forward into the president very strongly represented, clearly represented as being something Obama has said about himself today.
Well, of course, first of all, 4 years ago, the Obama campaign was basically saying that it was a McCain campaign statement when, of course, it wasn't. It was never attributed to anybody. And two, I still think the DNC hysterics over the Romney ad are way over the top.
Well, maybe the DNC hysterics are over the top, but an awful lot of journalists also pounced on this and said, this is the very first ad Mitt Romney has put out as a presidential candidate 2012. And this is the way he chooses to represent his opponent. And what kind of signal does that send about the kind of campaign that Mitt Romney is planning to run?
Look at the campaign that President Obama is running, you know, running around the country saying how deceitful the Republicans are. So, look, it's going to be a dirty campaign. We know that. Any illusions that Mitt Romney is going to run an honorable campaign is ridiculous. But I think the whole point of the Romney ad is, like, if Obama rightfully discussed the importance of the economy in 2008 and the Republicans' poor record of it, I think his point is, well, let's turn it around on President Obama in 2012. I think in the debate also we saw more of John Huntsman than we have in the past.
Yeah.
And John Huntsman is clearly running to be president of the Mormon Church. No, I think John Huntsman is clearly running to get under Mitt Romney's skin. First of all, John Huntsman knows that his only chance for anything is a victory in New Hampshire because he's basically pulled out of Iowa. And the roadblock for John Huntsman in New Hampshire is Mitt Romney. So it seems like every kind of response that John Huntsman has about policy, about stuff in the debate, has always been directed at Mitt Romney. John Huntsman also was on Saturday Night Live last week. He almost became the Bruce Babbitt, or I don't know what other
word. That's good. That's good. Now we're way back here, 1988, Bruce Babbitt, a candidate for the Democratic
nomination. But the favorite of the comedy shows, the shtick, and, you know, somehow going on Jon Stewart.
Well, he is. He's the media favorite and has been since the beginning of his campaign.
Yeah, but that doesn't work in Republican primaries, shall we say.
Oh, that's the mistake he made, running in the Republican Party.
Well, he is a conservative. I mean, the thought of the conservative saying that John Huntsman is in the wrong party, and then that's ludicrous. He is very conservative, but not as conservative as seven other people on that stage.
Well, and the most frustrated guy on the stage has got to be Rick Santorum, because it seems to me that on social issues, foreign policy issues, fiscal issues, across the board, he is the guy who is most consistently in tune with the Republican base voter. And yet he just doesn't seem to be able to get any kind of traction in South Carolina or Iowa or New Hampshire. I don't know why.
Well, he is well organized in Iowa. He's, you know, he has a bunch of troops out there. He doesn't have much money, and yet his record is as spotless, if you're a conservative, as you can get. And I guess, you know, part of the thing is that when he talks all about his service, you know, 12 years in the Senate from Pennsylvania, he doesn't mention that in 2006 he got defeated by 17 points to Bob Casey. So I kind of think that Rick Santorum's time has come and gone, and there are other newer conservatives who have taken their places.
There is something kind of off-putting about him too, and I don't think that he has, you know, a great galvanic skin response from people when he meets them totally as strangers. I don't think that he comes across as somebody they would like to see in the office. Now, maybe it's hard to see some of these other guys
in
the office.
I was going to say, as you're saying this, I'm thinking Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich reminds me of a long gone era of the 80s and 90s, and he's out of office since 98. He resigned because he overdid the Clinton impeachment stuff and the Monica Lewinsky stuff, and it hurt his Republican Party in 98.
See, actually, I don't think that's why he resigned. What Gingrich resigned over was because he was no longer really the leader of his own revolution. They had already had a palace coup and tried to get rid of him before he resigned in 98. He resigned because they had promised 20 new seats in the 98 midterm elections.
They, meaning he promised it too.
The leaders had, and then he, Gingrich, was not able to deliver those additional seats. In fact, they actually lost seats, right, which is almost unheard of in a president's second midterm, especially if that president is on the brink of being impeached. So Gingrich really went down for political reasons inside his own caucus.
I think you may very well be right, but the point is he seemed like a character from the past, from another era, and the fact that he's now, with 6 weeks to go, among the leaders, whatever that means anymore, because, you know, the polls keep shifting, but he's up there, and he's not somebody I would have thought that voters say, he's the guy I want in the White House. But they might want to see him debate President Obama toe-to-toe.
That I think they would like.
And one person we shouldn't forget, especially in a foreign policy debate on the Republican side, is Ron Paul, because on issues, as always, as we saw 4 years ago, Ron Paul is the lone solitary voice on things like torture, on foreign aid, on troops abroad. And while he doesn't sound like a Republican, or at least a modern-day Republican, matter of fact,
he sounds like a pre-World War II
Republican, like an isolationist. Right, exactly.
America first. And when somebody brought up the war on drugs, he said, that's another war that ought to be canceled. I mean, he really is a different flavor. He is a completely different kind of mindset on that stage. And so, as you say, especially in a foreign policy debate, it's entertaining and provocative to have him there making pretty strong, coherent arguments for why we don't need to spend half the money that the whole world spends on military hardware. Maybe we don't have to have 11 aircraft carriers. Maybe 10 would be enough.
And 4 years ago, when he talked about against the war in Iraq and against the war in Afghanistan, perhaps not so popular in 2008, perhaps more popular in 2012.
And interestingly, this debate this week was before the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation, along with a lot of other guests who were invited. But it was that kind of crowd. And he was getting as much applause, at least by my meters, as any of the other candidates. He was getting a very positive response from his particular group of people in that audience. There is an audience, I think, for his particular kind of foreign policy views in the Republican Party.
And we, as we've said before, 2012 will be a different animal when we come to the primaries and caucuses, because it will be proportional in the early contest. So rather than winner take all, Ron Paul can get his share of delegates, and he's not going to go away anytime soon, nor should he.
You know who will go away sometime soon, and
The Super Committee?
The Super
Committee. Oh, no. I had such hope for them.
I have hope for them, too. I think they should be restored to their families. And I think that they should all sit around and cut the turkeys.
Look, I don't know how anybody could have been surprised, given the fact that the Republicans were never going to bend on taxes and the Democrats could only go so far on offering concessions on entitlements.
I thought it was interesting, and you know, here I suppose we're going to sound like we're more on one side than the other, but I thought it was interesting that the Democrats were apparently willing to take some pretty serious hits from their base, if you will, with respect to entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, probably not Social Security, but hey, maybe raising the age on Social Security.
No, I don't think they would have turned.
No, not that. They weren't going to go that far. All right. But they were going to give some ground. But they had to get some revenue, and it had to come from more affluent people, or they just weren't going to be able to sell that back home. And they weren't really met halfway. The Republicans proposed tax reform, as they called it, to garner $250 billion in additional revenue. But the price tag on that was making the Bush tax cuts permanent, which would cost $800 billion over the same period of time. So that's going in the opposite direction in terms of revenue. It's a little hard. I mean, I realize the Republicans are doing this out of principle, that this is what they believe in. I believe they believe in it. But
I believe that you believe that they believe
in it. If there's not going to be any compromise at all on this fundamental question between North and South, civil war.
And even when Pat Toomey offered the $250 to $300 billion in concessions on taxes, Grover Norquist and those people said, wait, says who? I mean, you know, you didn't get our permission.
That's right. And that means you can't pass it through the House. And if you can't pass it through the House, you don't really have a deal.
And of course, even if it gets passed through the House, you know it's not going to go anywhere in the Senate. And we're back to again, but you know, and I saw somewhere it says, well, we'll know more after the 2012 elections.
Why?
What's going to change?
Well, okay, here's what could change.
Tell me what.
We could elect a conservative Republican president, a more Republican House of Representatives, and a Republican Senate. And one would assume...
A 60-member Republican Senate?
Well, not 60. Well, there would still be the usual problems with getting a supermajority in the Senate. But if we had a president and a Congress like we had with George W. Bush and the Congresses immediately thereafter in the early part of the last decade, presumably they would cut taxes further, as they did then, and they would also, we assume, go after entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, so as to get the savings they say we need to get.
You know what I'm thinking? As you're saying that, I'm picturing the Democrats in the summer of 2009, pre-Scott Brown, and saying, well, the Democrats had that advantage. They had
60% in both chambers.
They had 60% in the Senate. They had a big majority in the House. They had a liberal Democratic president. And the debt ceiling, you know, all these things that coulda, shoulda, woulda, they didn't.
Yes. And I realize that the Democrats did not make the most of their last opportunity when they had all three of these power levers that we're talking about. But they also did pass that health care bill.
They did.
And they did pass Dodd-Frank, the re-regulation of the financial industry, whatever else you think of it. They passed a lot of bills that were tough to pass, that were unpopular to some measure.
Cost a lot of Democrats their seats.
Which cost a lot of people their seats. But they did press ahead with the votes they had and tried to pursue as much of their agenda as they could. I think the Republicans would do the same, especially if they had a Republican president who wanted to be aggressive. If that man is named Mitt Romney, my guess is he doesn't want to be that aggressive, and that the Republicans, especially in the Senate, will not want to be that aggressive. And so you may be right. We may be in the same no compromise but no progress soup when it comes to the federal deficit.
And the conflict may very well be within the Republican Party, not D's versus R's, but R's versus R's.
And that's our podcast this week.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too, Ron.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.